It's the Insight into Insight edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, prediction fail, dough on Doha, an interview with Dr. Kerr on Vancouver's Insight program and harm reduction. Let's begin episode 195.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. For me, the stars are your way. The cosmos can know it all.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. Much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher, who must apologize. I have a bit of a cold, and every so often my voice may go wandering on me. So I'm going to start off by apologizing for the poor quality of my most excellent voice.
Yes, well, it's been going around these past few days.
It has been. How was your holidays? We've been away for a little while.
Yeah.
I hope people missed us terribly.
I'm sure they must have been crying into their stockings.
Yes. We should also make a little note that the podcasts have been a little foobarred and are expected to be continued to be foobarred for the next couple of weeks. We are attempting to create our own sort of podcast feed, which will be available on our website, so you can check that out. But Ethan,
yes.
We may not have a chance to do the podcast anymore. The end is nigh. Boom, boom, boom.
The end is nigh, like Bill Nye?
No, well, that would be... Actually, yeah, let's call it a bit of both, because it's kind of cool science, cool not. There is something called Apophis, which, of course, is the god of darkness in the Egyptian mythology, I believe. It measures about 270 meters, or about 3 football fields. It has a mass that's roughly equivalent to the energy of 250,000 Hiroshima bombs if it were to smash into the Earth. And you say, Dawn, does it have any chance of smashing into Earth? And I go, yes. Well, not really. On January 9th, it will pass by the Earth by 14.5 million kilometers, which I think is just outside the moon's orbit, but it's still relatively, oh my God, really close. And that's like, say, January 9th, and you should be able to, it should be able to be seen in certain parts of the world. I haven't quite been able to figure out where. But that's just one of the things that are, like, really scary coming up this year. I mean, the Mayans, they may have been right, except just off in their calculations a little bit. On February 15th, a 57-meter asteroid called 2012 DA14, cool name, will skim past the planet at just about 35,000 kilometers, which, for those of you who are really up on your geosynchronous orbity type stuff, will be between the Earth and satellites. So not only will it come really, really close to the Earth, but it might knock out broadcasting satellites, GPS satellites. I believe someone at SGU had predicted that for last year. And that's just the asteroids. Now, there are some nice fancy shows coming up as well with regards to comets. Comet 2011 L4, or Pan-STAR, see, they at least came up with a cool name for
it. Yeah, that's pretty good.
We'll be coming by around March 8th to March 12th, and that should be, again, a nice light show in the sky. But the highlight of the year is Comet Ison, which should become visible to the naked eye in November. Some say it might be brighter than the full moon. Some people are doubting that. This is believed to be the first time this particular comet has come by the planet Earth, so we really have no idea what it's composed of or what have you. There is some great opportunity for some cool science, because if it is the first time it's been near the sun, it will have some of the, you know, starting stuff of the solar system, and that might be interesting for scientists to observe.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll obviously keep our eye on that. When those comets come around, we'll mention to our listeners, you guys, how you can see them, and hopefully they'll be in our quadrant of the sky. You know, I really hate it when, you know, Australia gets all the stuff.
And yeah, I know, especially like the cool eclipses and all that.
Yeah.
It's almost like a cosmological plot.
A conspiracy theory.
It could be. Speaking of theories and conspiracy, you may have noticed, but it's now 2013, and 2012 is past us. There have been a number of psychics who came up with some well, interesting, bizarre, and just plain weird predictions in 2012. And, well, I thought we'd take a look at one or two of them and just see how they turned out.
Okay, we can do that.
Now, I'm not going to mention any of the particular procrastinators' names because I don't really want to promote them. Mm-hmm. But these are all high-end, top-of-the-line, big-money sort of predictors. Some of them are just in the sort of just plain wrong category. So you have one of them said unemployment in the U.S. To fall to about 9.5%. Jobs in demand will be healthcare, science, technology, senior caretaker, and job overseers. Now, first of all, healthcare and seniors, I mean, that's not really a big stretch there. But they were quite off the mark because actually the unemployment rate in the United States was 7.7. So way off on that one. Those people who would use psychics and that to invest, I hope you did because you deserve what you get. They predicted that gold would reach $2,000 an ounce and oil would hit 130 barrels. As it turns out, gold's only been about $1,800 an ounce. Never really even, never came close to 2,000. And oil, again, not even close, not even for a moment to hit 130. And actually, I think it's gone down below $100 now.
Yeah, those are pretty high numbers, aren't they? I mean, I'm no expert on gold and oil, but those are pretty high estimations.
Those are. And actually, you know, a lot of these psychic predictions, take a look at what sort of the news is and what are some of the, like, I mean, they are kind of based on, I don't want to say real science, it's not the right word, but there are economists who say, well, we think this might be a projection, and they just say, well, I'm going to guess that, and then I'll say, ah, see, I saw the future, because you do the whole percentage, you throw out 100 and some predictions, and if 10 of them come true, everyone forgets the 90 that you missed on, and say, see, I knew it. Mm-hmm. Like I say, you know, some of the other big losses were earthquake in Mexico City destroys most of the city, which, of course, I think Mexico City's still there.
Pretty much, yeah.
Giant earthquake hits California. Again, didn't happen. Of course, both of those, I mean, they're earthquake zones. There were a number of the predictions that said that there will be an earthquake, a major earthquake in the West Coast, and like, duh. I mean, there's always an earthquake on the West Coast. That's not really a prediction. One I liked, and again, you could argue this one kind of came true, giant prehistoric sea monster under the sea. Now, of course, if it's a sea monster, you wouldn't expect it in the desert, but but I mean, you know, you go back, you say, well, what does that mean, right? And I don't know if people have been noticing on the web, but there's been the giant octopus video that's been sort of going on, right?
The giant squid, you mean?
Giant squid, sorry. Well, yeah. Giant squid video. And I mean, the giant squid is seen as a prehistoric type creature and all that. So is that what they meant or not what they meant? You know, there's that.
Well, do they mean alive or dead? Because they found some pretty big sea monster fossils. Well, monster in quotation marks, dinosaurs. Does that count? Or does it have to be alive? Because I think if you say prehistoric sea monster under the sea, I don't know. I'm leaning towards a live sea monster under the sea.
Well, yeah, because we haven't quite advanced our archaeological abilities to do actual archaeology under the sea yet. Although that's one of the areas that's really kind of cool and interesting to do.
Yes.
A lot of the ocean. So some of the other ones, stock market crash, which didn't happen. Actually, the economy's kind of picked up. Although, I'll give the Republicans credit. They definitely tried to make that happen, not only in the United States, but everywhere else. And also, to be fair, Europe, with its whole string of austerity, is trying to make that one come true as well. An Iranian revolution is seen before late summer, where spiritual leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei or President Mohammad Ahmadinejad are removed from power. Now, again, this is one of those ones that's you made a prediction, and I go out there, but if you knew a lot about the politics of Iran, you know that there had been a power struggle between these two particular groups in Iran. And, I mean, there was a good chance that one of them would be toppled in this. And it kind of, Ahmadinejad kind of was fell from favor, but he wasn't kicked out. And the way it makes a revolution, that's a big word.
And again, that's a prediction that's kind of high probability because of, you know, you look at the recent revolutions that have been happening in the Middle East, and people have been saying for a long time that Iran is sort of on that precipice of having a revolution. So it's not like that's a shot in the dark, right? If they had given dates.
Well, you know, and I have a prediction for this year that there may be an election in this province.
Yes. I think that's a very, very good prediction.
That being said, of course, some of them did predict Romney to have won the election. Another one I liked, which I thought was kind of again, vaguely interesting. A conflict or battle in outer space will occur this year between two countries, most likely involving Russia or Iran, when communication satellites are attacked. Again, I had missed this one if it was in the news. But, I mean, that's like Star Wars. And I mean, that's...
Why would you pick Russia and Iran? Why wouldn't you pick Russia and China or Russia and America?
Well, and that's actually one of the ironies of this, is that there are two nations that have sort of done this kind of thing before. China notoriously shot down one of its own satellites I think a couple years ago. And the Americans have done a similar thing, right? So if you'd said one of them, I mean, at least then you're sort of like touching the truth. You know, I mean, there's at least a plausibility.
Yeah.
But I think they wanted to kick on Iran. That was a good thing. Of course, there's supposed to be major riots in Miami and London in the spring. And again, for London, the year before, there were riots. So not super crazy, but definitely just winging it. And then, of course, poor Tiger Woods was supposed to win the U.S. Open. And, well, you're more into sports, Ethan, did he?
He did not.
No.
No, poor Tiger.
Loser. Now, so those are the ones that are just sort of like, okay, those are predictions. But some of the ones that I came across, and this is mainly large based on one or two articles that I saw, and they'll be on our show notes. But some of them are like, do these really even qualify as predictions? So, for example, some area of land disappears. What the hell does that mean, right? One of them said, there'll be a new spiritual truth. Another one, the United Arab Emirates hides internal problems. Now, this isn't a, oh my God, but I mean, every group hides problems. That's just the way it is. Radio Free Thinker hides its internal problems. You'll never know about the horrible infighting that goes on after, no. Politicians will continue to make changes, a woman will come up through the ranks who will not be known right now, and she will bring positive changes. She may not be elected in 2012, but she will be rising. So again, 50% of the population you're dealing with, and you're saying there'll be some female politician who may make good. Odds are pretty good with you on that one. And again, you know, you're not, there's no, what was another one? Letting go of negative patterns, more acceptance of positive patterns and choice.
That's not even a statement of something about to happen. That's just like a vague, pseudosciencey thing to say.
And some of them are like past ones. One of them said, a nuclear project in the Middle East. Again, no specifics. So you could mean Iran. You could mean Syria. You could mean Israel. All of them have been known to dabble in the nuclear thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the big things that comes from all this, I mean, these people are trying to claim that they have these superpowers and they can see into the future. So I would sit there, if you knew that someone was going to be murdered and you did nothing, that makes you an accessory to the crime. So one of the big fails of this year is the whole idea of the Newtown shooting, right? And the Aurora shooting, which was also this year. And, you know, these psychics claim that they can see this. And some of them did, actually. One of them said, homegrown terrorists target schools, which, again, vague enough that they could mean anything. But if they knew about it, I mean, why couldn't they know exactly where it was? And why didn't they give sort of a specific warning saying, hey, you need to watch out for here? I mean, that's almost criminally culpable.
It's even more depressing is that you can make a prediction like that and expect it to come true. A school shooting this year. Like, that's... And it probably will happen. Like, I mean, that's just the way things are. That's just really depressing.
It is incredibly depressing. But... yeah, it amazes me the people who will fall in for this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, quite famously, Nancy Reagan, back in the Reagan years, had her own special astrologer that she'd follow and psychic who'd do all that sort of thing. You know, before the show, we were kind of talking a bit about, you know, what is the harm? And to a certain degree, you can see this as kind of entertainment. And, okay, that's it. But it's not taken as entertainment, not only so much by the people who read it, who can be gullible, but the people who peddle it are peddling it as if it were actually true.
Yeah. You know? There's a big difference between, say, an astrologer or a psychic like Sylvia Brown and, say, Penn and Teller, who come out and say, listen, we're going to fool you now. We're going to do a trick. It's not magic. It's sleight of hand. And you're going to enjoy it. versus I'm really psychic and, oh yeah, you know, your kid who ran away from home is dead somewhere. You know, like there's a level of nefariousness here that is not present in the entertainment aspect of it. And that's what people seem to miss. And that's something that we're trying to hammer home, because there is harm. People do get hurt by this kind of thing. It happens a lot, and it's, you know, it's a shame that we have, you know, newspapers that promote this kind of crap.
Well, there's a legal case going now in, I think it's Texas, about a psychic who thought they saw a murder in a particular, like, a farm town, right? Mm-hmm. And the cops went in there and they raided the home. They did actually, I think, twice. And the couple that whose lives were disrupted by this is suing the psychic for malicious intent, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of predictions, now, the Vancouver Courier, a local newspaper here in Vancouver, has shamefully, in my opinion, put on their front page, the year in stars, a bunch of predictions by their astrologer for 2013. I thought, no, we've done the past predictions. Let's take a look at future predictions.
Just for reference, when you first started mentioning this year in stars, I was hoping it's like, you know, what's Madonna going to do this year?
Yeah.
What's up with the, you know, but...
Or even better, what's going to happen with those comets?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at some of these, quote, predictions. The first one here, the U.S. recovery predicted last year has begun and should last until the mid-2015 when worldwide inflation or deflation brings the storm clouds again. The fiscal cliff won't be steep. Now, this is not a prediction. This is a vague statement about complex matters. The term won't be steep could mean anything.
Well, and actually even worse than that, because, I mean, specifically the fiscal cliff was a thing, right, that everyone was referring to, and it actually, they never really went over it. It didn't actually ever happen.
Right? Well, I mean, some people don't even understand what it was in the first place.
Yeah, so we won't go into that. We could go into great detail, but it was one of those things, you know, where you had to come up with an agreement at a particular time, and if you didn't, then horrible things might happen, but they came up with the deal more or less on time. So, yeah. I mean, so he's wrong right off the bat, let alone whether it was steep or not.
So the next prediction, oil prices will remain soft for the first 6 months, impacting the West. The real estate market, boosted since 2009 by Ottawa's low interest rates, now holds these as a soft landing parachute until 2015. And again, this is not a prediction. What does soft landing parachute even mean? Again, these vague metaphors that could be interpreted as any kind of result. So, first of all, I don't even think this is right either. I think that the real estate market is actually going down, if I'm not mistaken. And soft landing parachute, like what? So if the markets crash, but it's not too bad, does that mean there was a soft landing parachute?
Yeah, no.
Wouldn't it be more accurate to say that it was like a really big parachute? Wouldn't that make more sense?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, and you get the thing too. I mean, this is a good example of, I mean, if you got these charts and, you know, you're saying this is all scientific, it should be more specific.
Yeah, right? A little bit. Well, get a little of the next one. Okay, this is a good one. Governments, institutions, hospitals, factories, all swell like sponges in water.
Ooh.
Now, I admit that I am not up to date on sponges, but I don't really understand what this means.
Well, yeah, and actually, so if they had stopped at governments or even hospitals, you could say, okay, you're probably making some sort of, you know, conservative move that they're getting bloated with more jobs and more money. But, I mean, institutions and factories, I mean, how does that metaphor even apply to those?
Yeah, that's a good question. Prediction number four, technologies will fight each other, e.g. Apple versus Samsung. Again, this is not a prediction. Your vacuum cleaner could have told you this.
Duh. And actually, there's rumor has it that actually Apple and Samsung are beginning to come to terms, right? Apple just dropped one of its suits against Samsung.
There's been less of these sort of crazy lawsuits. Number five, we will see severe clashes of army versus citizens or hierarchy versus rebels. The U.S. might start a small war in June, July. And this is hedging his bets because might and brief are get out of jail cards, just as army versus citizens or hierarchy versus rebels. The civil unrest happens every year all over the world. And how do you even qualify, like, what's a war? If the U.S., you know, mounts an aggressive rescue operation in Somalia. Does that count as a conflict? I mean, what does this mean?
Using your analogy to the vacuum cleaner, you may or may not have heard, but there's a little bit of a to-do going on in Syria.
Yes, I have heard of this.
And more political pundits are beginning to acknowledge the fact that Assad is gone and the West is supporting the rebels. So would that qualify as sort of a brief war, a hierarchy versus rebels, you know?
Well, let's go on to number six. This is one that I think, we can agree with. Dreamers and mystics square off against logical pragmatists, which is anticipating the response his drivel will provoke. Number seven, expect marijuana wars, hospital wars, naval expansion and confrontations. I have no idea what a hospital war is, and marijuana has always been a hot topic, especially with the recent elections in the States. So that's not really a prediction either.
Well, and so I have to, I didn't read this, Ethan read this particular article. Is that literally how it was written on the page?
Yes, yeah. Don't want to speak
well, I understand where the marijuana war is. It's his addiction to something.
Yes, yeah.
Battling with reality.
So, number eight, spirituality will flourish, as will research in ocean sciences, optics, and astrophysics. And again, this is not a prediction. These things happen every year. And I mean, maybe if you were like a total, you know, you had knew nothing about physics, but hey, maybe you heard about Curiosity landing, maybe you heard about the Higgs boson. So, yeah, you know, maybe there will be some advancements in physics, you know, who knows?
I would be more impressed if he had said there will be no research on these topics. I'm going, what? How could that possibly be?
Yes, research will suddenly stop on these things. Let's see, number nine, everyday business will go well. Large matters such as international trade will meet, quote, legal barriers. This is ludicrously vague. It's like saying at some point it's going to rain. Number 10, this will be sad for some listeners. Grisly crime shows like Bones or CSI will lose audiences. Brighter, lighter fare will catch a ratings train. We'll see more of Mum Knows Best family value shows. Homelessness as a dark comedy. I don't know about the last part there, but the lose audiences, well, how much? Which shows will be canceled? What networks will have new shows? Who will star in them? These vague statements that are sort of unfalsifiable. So he doesn't say, you know, Bones will be canceled or CSI will be canceled. He just says shows like Bones or CSI will be canceled. Well, I'm sure that somewhere there is a show like Bones that sucks and will be canceled.
Well, and again, I'm trying to fathom how the thought process goes when he's constructing these particular... I mean, does he look at the charts and does he see bad ratings and then he sees, you know, like, how do you even come up with this kind of dribble? Unless, of course, you're just guessing.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think
he's supposed to have source material here, right? I mean, this is.
Well, like I assume he's looking at the stars. I mean, that's what the article was called. I mean, unless the courier was lying to us, but that would never happen.
Maybe he's going for a new series. You know, you have Dancing with the Stars. Now it's Babel with the Stars.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. I like that. I like that. Let's take a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll return after this.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Freethinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
On Radio Freethinker.
Well, we have in our studio someone special. We have Dr. Thomas Carr, the co-director of Addiction and Urban Health Research at UBC, as well as among a number of other things. But he's in our studios today because he's going to give us some insight and the idea of harm reduction. Welcome, Dr. Carr.
Yeah, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, we have you in here because you are a specialist and expert. You know a lot of stuff about the idea of harm reduction with regards to drug use and that sort of thing. So let's start off with the basic topic. What is harm reduction, and what's its relationship to drug addiction?
Sure. Well, harm reduction in the broadest sense is really a set of policies and programs that seek to reduce the harms of illicit drug use without necessarily requiring abstinence from drugs. So there's actually harm reduction is not really just restricted to the area of drug policy, but it's found in many other areas. For example, don't drink and drive campaigns are really a form of harm reduction. They accept that people will drink, but the message is if you drink too much, don't drive and harm yourself and other people. And we also know that in the area of drug use, that simply telling people to not use drugs is not a very effective approach. And that although, there are some effective treatments, for many people, these don't always work very well. And so harm reduction programs serve an important function by keeping people free of disease and alive while they're in phases of active drug use.
So in particular, to give us a bit more of a hard example, the Insight Project here in Vancouver is harm reduction in action. So what exactly does Insight do? What services does it provide? And let's start with that.
Sure. Well, Insight is North America's first supervised injection facility. And there, people can bring their own illicit drugs that they have obtained. And they can inject under the supervision of a nurse. They're provided with the materials they need to inject as safely as possible. If they experience an overdose, there are nurses there to provide emergency resuscitation. And also guidance on how to inject in the least harmful way possible. There are also counselors and other healthcare professionals, as well as peer workers on site, who provide countless referrals to external programs such as addiction treatment and housing and the like. The facility was opened in 2003 as a 3-year scientific pilot study. And it's open 18 hours a day from 10 a.m. till 4 a.m. And on average, about 700 to 1,000 people visit the facility each day.
One thing I'm curious, you mentioned that they provide the material for the user to do his thing, but they don't provide the drugs itself, but they provide needles and that sort of thing.
That's correct. People bring their own drugs that they have obtained. And but once in the facility, they go through a registration process, and eventually they're called into a very tightly controlled injecting room where they can access various supplies they need to inject in the most sterile and safe manner as possible. And another important feature of the facility is that it attracts people who historically inject in public spaces and alleyways and on streets. And so in addition to having a public health benefit, there's also a public order benefit. But injecting within public spaces has been shown over and over again around the world through rigorous research to be extremely dangerous. It's associated with overdose as well as a range of injection-related infections. When people are injecting in public spaces because they fear confrontations with police or others, they often inject as quickly as possible. They skip many of the steps that need to be taken to ensure the safest possible injection.
One of the things that you'd mentioned, you said this is the first safe injection site in North America, which implies that there have been other injection sites elsewhere in the world. What is the sort of scientific certainty that this is a positive aspect?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because you're right. There are about 90 supervised injection facilities in the world. There are also some facilities where people can inhale drugs such as crack cocaine and heroin. Supervised injection facilities have been around for decades in many European jurisdictions. However, the approach there was much more one of practicality. People said, look, this makes sense. It's obviously safer and much more aligned with both public health and public order goals to have people inject in this healthcare environment than having them inject in a park or in an alleyway. And it just made sense. So people went ahead and did it. They looked to see if there was any negative consequences. There was none, so they continued. However, When a facility opened in Sydney, Australia, and then subsequently in Vancouver, there was much more public outcry and much more demand for some greater level of scientific rigor. So in both settings, these facilities were subjected to a very rigorous evaluation. And in Vancouver, there was a long-standing evaluation that our group led. There are now approximately 40 peer-reviewed publications that speak to the benefits and the lack of negative impacts of InSight. These papers appear in some of the world's best journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, the British Medical Journal, the Lancet, and the like. And the findings are very consistent with the anecdotal experience in Europe. We found that the facility is helping to improve public order by bringing people off the street and inside to a healthcare environment. So less needles on the street, less people injecting. We've also found that the facility is helping to facilitate entry into detoxification programs and long-term addiction treatment by referring people to those facilities. We've also found that the facility is reducing both the risk of non-fatal but also fatal overdose. In fact, there was a 35% decline in overdose deaths in the area around InSight following its opening. There's been a host of other benefits that I won't get into. But importantly, we knew that this was a controversial intervention, and we took it upon ourselves to make sure that there wasn't any negative impacts. So using Vancouver Police Department's own crime statistics, we demonstrated the facility did not, the opening of the facility did not result in an increase in crime. It's not send the wrong message to young people and led more people to start injecting for the first time. And it hasn't made community drug use patterns worse by, you know, making the environment more comfortable for injecting.
One of the things that I learned about in your talk for CFI Vancouver a couple months ago, you spoke about the rigor and the level of detail that you guys put into your studies. You even controlled for Vancouver weather to make sure that everything that you could possibly show was accounted for. Tell us a bit more about the detail and the effort you guys put into that.
Yeah, well, we knew that this was a very controversial intervention. We are also aware that, you know, there are very well-funded lobby groups out there, such as the Drug Free America Foundation, which pour, you know, perhaps, you know, certainly thousands, if not millions of dollars into kind of perpetuating the status quo and politicizing the science in relation to harm reduction. It's been done with needle exchange and other programs which have been shown again and again to be effective and not harmful. So we knew that this would be controversial, so we decided that rather than simply writing a report at the end of 3 years that could be dismissed as being, you know, inadequate or incomplete or, you know, methodologically not rigorous, we instead conducted a series of shorter studies. We submitted them for independent scientific peer review at the world's best medical journals. Only when they passed the test of independent scientific peer review and were accepted for publication by the international scientific community did we even speak about them publicly. So it had to have that stamp of appeal, that independent scientific review. And in that way, we used the international system of scientific peer review to kind of protect ourselves against allegations. Unfortunately, they came anyway, but at the end of the day, it was definitely a case of science over ideology.
That was actually leads into, I guess, the next issue is the whole legality of it. Famously, InSight was challenged by the Harper government as being not effective, immoral, against law, what have you. So can you tell us a bit about that that struggle?
Yeah, it was a really difficult one. You know, the facility was opened up under the leadership of the former federal Liberal government when Stephen Harper was running as leader for the first time. He made many negative comments, which really didn't reflect the evidence. He said he'd be looking to the RCMP for their evaluation of this initiative. And interestingly, the RCMP actually paid two consultants to do an evaluation of our evaluation. And they didn't release those evaluations, and eventually they were leaked to the media. Why didn't they release them? Well, one perspective is that that's because those evaluations were positive and confirmed and stood by our results, saying that the evidence seems to be that this is working, it's doing what it's supposed to do, it's not harmful. But again, the RCMP didn't release those when they were leaked to the media. They issued a statement distancing themselves from those reports. Later, the Drug Prevention Network of Canada, which is a group that was started by former Reform and Conservative Party member Randy White, came out with a report on a website called the Global Journal of Drug Policy and Practice, alleging that the whole evaluation methodology was flawed and that really Insight was very harmful. This was written by someone who actually has never published a peer-reviewed study involving human subjects, has no university affiliation, and is essentially unknown in scientific circles. As well, the journal ended up just being a website, really pretending to be a peer-reviewed journal, and it was funded by the Drug Free America Foundation. So it was a very clever attempt to try and make a website look like a journal. Eventually, the Pivot Legal Society issued a number of freedom information requests, and it was revealed that members of the RCMP actually paid this individual to write this anti-safe injection site report. And eventually, that was something the RCMP apologized for. But that didn't stop the Drug Free America and Drug Free Australia from continuing to harass us. Eventually, it led to them demanding that the Lancet retract our paper on overdose. The Lancet ignored that. They lobbied the Supreme Court of Canada to dismiss evidence related to overdose. The Supreme Court ignored those requests. And then, so they weren't satisfied, so they actually lodged a complaint at the University of British Columbia demanding that myself and my colleagues be put under investigation for scientific misconduct or issues related to scholarly integrity. That complaint was externally reviewed by an internationally recognized expert in the field and found to be completely without merit. They still weren't happy. So they went after the postdoc fellow who led the study on overdose in the Lancet, who was cross-appointed to Columbia University. They submitted a complaint there as well. They also reviewed the complaint and found it to be completely without merit. So it really was a case of science being grossly politicized, and when people didn't get what they wanted, they started to harass and threaten scientists.
So they went so much effort to do this, to discredit you guys. Why? What were you doing that was threatening them so badly that they had to resort to these efforts to discredit you?
Well, I think it's a case where, you know, things are really changing now. I think there's a growing awareness that the current system of drug control and prohibition is not only ineffective, but it's actually responsible for a huge amount of harm and is a contributing factor to the global HIV epidemic among people who use drugs. And there's been increasing calls for a complete policy reorientation. I think what was particularly difficult for people who like the status quo when it comes to Insight is that it required an exemption from the federal health minister, which essentially allowed people to carry drugs into the facility. So they were exempt from the possession laws within the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. They saw this as the pathway to the legalization of drugs. Mm. And so I think it was a tipping point and symbolic of a much broader concern. And they felt that, well, if this was allowed, then the floodgates were going to open. And if we don't stop this, we're going to be in big trouble. And, you know, that's the, if you read the article in the Global Journal of Drug Policy and Practice, it talks a lot about the parent philosophy, and it's very clear that that's a concern that's in play.
Hmm. One of the sad things is that this sort of witch hunt tactics has often been used against scientists who come up against some form of dogma, be it climate change or what have you. But the Supreme Court ruled, and they ruled in your favor, and it was actually, I think the way they actually decided it was quite a positive thing.
Yeah, it was unanimous, 9-0 in favor of the continuation of Insight. In fact, one of the justices asked the lawyers representing the federal government if they had any evidence to suggest that Insight wasn't working, and they had to admit that they didn't. In fact, they didn't offer the work from Colin Mangham and the Drug Prevention Network of Canada. They just simply said they had no evidence. And I think it was very clear. I mean, the science was overwhelming. And please understand that it wasn't just our group at UBC that was saying we think this thing works. The Canadian Medical Association, the Canadian Association of Nurses, the Canadian Public Health Association all sought intervener status to say, we think the science is strong, we support this initiative, and it should continue. So really, the entire scientific, medical, nursing, public health community in Canada stood as one voice and said, you know, enough's enough. Let's quit arguing about this thing. It works. Let's move on. There's other problems we need to solve.
So from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the way the Supreme Court ruled, it actually was a charter right to go to Insight, that to deny someone from doing that was violating their charter rights. Is that a potential tool that can be used to see an expansion of this harm reduction policy across Canada, or is Insight going to remain a isolated endeavor?
Well, I think right now there's certainly talk about opening up additional facilities in other settings, such as Montreal. And I think we'll find out soon how difficult it's going to be. But I think if you look at the decision, and I'm not a legal expert, but it's very clear that the message is the federal health minister should really get out of the way, and that he should not fail to offer an exemption to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act when a certain initiative helps ensure the charter right to the highest attainable standard of health.
You mentioned a visit from the health minister to Insight at the CFI talk. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there, and this is what has been relayed to me. It's hearsay, but we were disappointed because certainly our research group made many overtures to the health minister to provide him with an in-person briefing. We had reached out to every major federal political party and was received with open arms. People were very interested, wanted information, but repeatedly the federal government refused to meet with us. Tony Clement refused to meet with us. He said rather disparaging things about our group within the House of Commons to the Standing House of Commons Committee on Health. And then in what I would regard as a rather cowardly move, he made a surprise kind of secret visit to Insight. And it has been alleged that he asked a staff member there how many of the people who come there each day are quote-unquote write-offs. And I think it speaks, to the perspective of this government with respect to people who live with addictions.
Absolutely. I mean, we want our health minister to be concerned with the welfare of our citizens.
Well, I think it's even deeper than that in one regard. I mean, healthcare and that sort of thing is a sort of a science endeavor, whereas he seems to be making a moral and ethical judgment and allowing that to rule the way the legislation should go. And I mean, to a certain degree, I mean, morals and ethics should play into this, but it should always be led by the science. We're not the only country in the world that has kind of done similar liberalizations in different areas. Notably, Portugal has decriminalized almost all, I think it's all drugs have been decriminalized there. The Netherlands is famous for having decriminalized soft drugs. Are there empirical lessons that we can learn from those particular experiences?
Yeah, I mean, those things have been, the relative merits and the benefits of those approaches have been debated quite heavily, and there are certainly some interesting things. The U.S. has invested literally billions of dollars to try and control the supply and use of cannabis. The Netherlands said we're going to allow people to access it in cafes, and the frequency of cannabis use among youth in the Netherlands is much lower than it is in the United States. So it kind of suggests that maybe that policy approach isn't working. Same with in Portugal. Again, the data has been debated. There's people who like to interpret in different ways, but I think most people agree that there has been an increase in admission to addiction treatment and a decline in the number of people being incarcerated. And let's remember that, when we criminalize what can be described as a health behavior, people are less likely to come forward and seek help for those from the health problems that stem from those behaviors. So it's not really surprising that when you criminalize, people are less likely to go to treatment. When you take away those criminal sanctions and there's not the threat of incarceration upon presentation to a hospital, you're more likely to show up.
Sorry, one other with regards to that sort of area that you're talking about, a lot of people, a lot of addiction, from what I understand, can also be tied to sort of self-medication. So there are other issues that are leading into this, and it would seem to me that it's almost crazy to think that throwing someone who may be suffering mental issues, throwing them into jail is somehow going to help. But the availability of drugs in jail too is another thing. So again, this seems to be another point that reinforces the idea that community-based harm reduction seems to be a much more rational choice to do than the alternatives that we have been following.
Yeah, no, and you know, the current system of criminalization has dramatically contributed to the HIV epidemic. A famous U.S.-based epidemiologist in Seattle did what we call an attributable risk analysis and concluded, based on the evidence coming out of Vancouver, that you know, in the late 90s, that approximately 20% of all new HIV infections acquired by people who inject drugs in Vancouver were acquired in prisons. So you're entirely right, drugs are available. And the sad thing is that even though drugs are less available in prisons than they are in the community, when drug use occurs there, it occurs in a much, much higher risk fashion.
Let's take a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here with Dr. Kerr.
You know, Ethan, there's something that I thought about, and you thought about as well. I should take sole credit for this.
It was a joint effort. We thought together.
Well, this show is a joint effort. The Canada often sees itself as a very progressive thing. We have, you know, healthcare, Medicare, and we're so much better than our southern neighbors on some of these things. You know, they have the American Bible Belt, and they're really kind of nutty conservatives down there. But yet, in the last election, two states passed the not only the decriminalization, but the legalization of marijuana, which I think actually couples one of the problems we often have with the idea of decriminalization is great, but you're still leaving sort of the bad guys in charge of supplying. But they've gone that one extra step where they've actually legalized the whole thing. It seems like Canada is not on the moral high ground. If anything, and you've listened to our show at all, you know I'm not a great fan of Harper government, that we are sliding back into the cave, as someone once said.
Yeah, no, it's really clear. I mean, if you look around the world, really the United States is not alone in this regard. A number of countries are experimenting with alternative regulatory approaches, and that's occurring in Latin America, it's occurring in Europe, and now in the United States. However, our government I would say, is actually taking massive steps backwards by removing harm reduction for the first time from the national drug strategy since it was first initiated in the 80s. They have introduced mandatory minimum sentences for various drug offenses, despite the fact that some of the most conservative elected officials from southern states in the U.S. warned our government that not only do these mandatory minimums not work, but they're not fiscally sustainable. And, you know, so really, you know, we have a very, very backward approach going on. And in fact, you know, if it's really not just a couple scientists here and there talking about these things. The World Health Organization and the United Nations programs on AIDS, and even the United Nations Office on Drug Control have issued technical setting guides recommending a set of what they see as essential programs to control the spread of HIV among people who inject drugs. And many of those programs are harm reduction programs. In fact, needle exchange, methadone maintenance feature very, very prominently in that technical setting guide. And yet we have a government that says we don't do harm reduction. So at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, who do you want to listen to? Stephen Harper or the World Health Organization? I'll take the World Health Organization every time.
Hmm. How... I mean, let's say, for instance, that we get a new government in a couple of years. Is it going to be difficult for them to get Canada back on course in harm reduction and health policy?
I don't think so, because I think the other parties have been very, very clear on their perspective. And I think, you know, any of the other parties would immediately pursue a much more... progressive approach to drug policy. Every other party expressed their clear support for insight. Many have expressed their support for alternative regulatory approaches to cannabis. And, you know, it was the former Liberal government that basically gave the okay on the insight initiative. So I really think any change, no matter what political stripes, will lead to a more positive approach to drug policy. Because right now, the approach we're taking has nothing to do with scientific evidence. It's a morally charged approach, and ultimately, it's compromising the health and safety of Canadians.
I'll leave you the out here of saying a yes/no answer. You don't have to elaborate, but there are a lot of people, you know, who think about the reason why the Conservative government has been this way, whether it's a strong fundamentalist clique within the party, the fact that there's a lot of money to be made out of prisons, so the idea of incarcerating prisons. But to be fair, there has been a bit of a backlash in Holland, in Netherlands, with regards to trying to roll back a bit of this liberalism. What do you think is really at the heart of this anathema of the Conservative Party with regards to drug policy?
Well, I think it's very clear that if you really survey the conservative landscape, you will find two very, very starkly different perspectives on drug policy. And the dividing line is really whether you're a fiscal conservative or you're a social conservative, because fiscal conservatives, you know, the Fraser Institute, Conrad Black and his friends, you know, the Cato Institute in the United States, they all strongly support harm reduction and alternative regulatory approaches. They think the current approach is an expensive failure, it doesn't work, and it wastes a lot of money. And some also go further to say a massive amount of tax revenue could be generated through an alternative regulatory approach. I do think, though, that there is a socially conservative perspective that says when you deviate from the accepted moral code, it's the state's job to punish you for that. So I really do think it's an ideological position, and it has nothing to do with scientific evidence. But I think, personally, that when we're talking about matters of life and death, we have an ethical and a moral obligation to base our decisions on the best available scientific evidence, and in this case, we're not doing it.
I find that actually you point at one of the great hypocrisies of it. You know, if they're making this moral stance because they say, you know, well, drug use is bad, but letting people die and suffer somehow isn't.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. Normally we go to our skeptical highlights. Maybe, Dr. Kerr, could you give us a skeptical highlight, perhaps some information about, say, how people could maybe get interested or involved in harm reduction, or ways that our listeners could make an impact on this matter?
Yeah, sure. I think that there's a number of organizations, such as the Canadian Harm Reduction Association, that does work in this area. Our own group initiated the International Center for Science and Drug Policy, and one of our initiatives was the Vienna Declaration, which calls for an alternative approach to drug policy. There's a whole host of organizations that are trying to push forward for another approach. Another is the Stop the Violence Coalition, which is pushing for an alternative regulatory approach to cannabis in British Columbia. I think people can check those things out and try and support that. And internationally, there's a whole host of groups, whether it's the Drug Policy Alliance, the Harm Reduction Coalition. All those groups are busy advocating for a more sensible approach to drug policy.
I think on top of that, I would contact my MLA or MP, whether you're conservative or not, let them know that this is not a peg you want the government to stand on, that you want them to put people's health ahead of any ideology. And I mean, I think that's a nonpartisan kind of issue that you can talk to any politician about, and you should. You should be involved. It's our government. We need to take action.
And I would actually recommend for some of our skeptic listeners to contact your favorite skeptic organization and say, hey, this whole inside harm reduction thing sounds pretty interesting. We need to get involved in this. And Radio Free Thinker is doing our part, so get on it.
Take the word to the street.
Absolutely.
So we're going to continue with our skeptic highlights. I have a skeptic highlight I want to bring up this week. And it's kind of along a similar thing. Idle No More meets Harper. For those people who are interested in the Indigenous movement that's been going on around Idle No More, they're having a meeting apparently January 11th with a bunch of leaders of the community. It's mainly focused on First Nation rights, but again, it's a pushback against the strongly autocratic Harper government. Hopefully they can make some headway, and if they do, it'll help with the rest of sort of a progressive movement in Canada to try to push back against this growing darkness that's covered our country. So I thought it'd be interesting for people to go see that.
Absolutely.
I have one light one. Vancouver's Comic-Con. We are skeptics. Skeptics are nerds by nature. It's happening Sunday, January 13th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission $4. It's at the Heritage Hall on Main in Vancouver. Go in there and get your geek on with comics.
Absolutely. I have two skeptical highlights as well. The first one is CFI Vancouver's book club, which is meeting on January 12th. And this month, we're reading Voodoo Histories, The Role of Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History by David Aronovich. Fantastic book, really interesting. Happening at the Grind and Galley Coffee Bar, again, January 12th at 1 p.m. And of course, our discussion group, CFI's Cafe Inquiry, meeting on January 19th. The topic is, has violence declined? And we'll be discussing Steven Pinker's latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Has Violence Declined? And of course, the central thesis that Pinker is arguing is that not only have we gotten more peaceful in terms of war, but also in personal violent assault and society and all that jazz. So we're going to look at some of the evidence for it, some of the criticism that he's received, and have a good discussion about that. That's in room 2200 of SFU Harbor Center at 1 p.m. January 19th.
And concealed guns are not welcome for that particular
reason. No violence at all.
Okay.
Excellent.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening, and thank you to Dr. Kerr for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So long, everybody.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not at sunrise, but at galaxy first.